we're recording this. Dad's a sleepyhead, but we're going to get him talking. And
Granddad
he'll be okay.
Has a cold.
Oh, poor Granddad has a cold.
Okay.
Questions.
All right. First question. Tell me when and where you were born.
Newark, New Jersey, June 17th, 1946, at St. Michael's Hospital.
Okay. And tell me about a memorable birthday.
Memorable birthday, I guess, would be the time your mother, when we were in high school, had my 18th birthday. And it was the day that my sister had her appendix out. It was a surprise birthday party. My sister had the appendix out. I was awakened at 7 o'clock in the morning or 7:30 in the morning by my mother telling me that the principal from Aquinas Institute was on the phone and he needed to talk to me immediately. And it was the end of exams. We had finished all the Regents exams. And I had been told months before I only had to pass either physics, math, or I can't even remember what the other subject was, but I just had to pass one of those and I'd have enough Regents credits, et cetera, et cetera. And I passed all but physics, but it seems that I had busted my hand playing football this fall before in the middle of typing class, for which there was a Regents exam, and I, since I couldn't move any of my fingers on my left hand, stopped taking typing. And it seems that I was supposed to have taken a typing exam because otherwise I wasn't going to graduate because I didn't have enough hours or credits or whatever to graduate with a Regents diploma, which is the only way you could graduate from Aquinas, despite what they had told my father, that no, I wouldn't have to make up any Regents credits, but I had already had to take the world history exam on the same day that I took the American history exam and one other, so I had three-hour exams in one day. That was all behind me until they called up at 8 o'clock in the morning and said I had to come down, take the exam. I don't know. I had to take the typing exam. And Mrs. Malone, who had taught most of the parents of the kids who were there in the public schools, was a teacher, and she wore Depends, or whatever the equivalent was to Depends back then. And she was beside herself with sorrow, and she said, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And I said, well, that makes two of us. And after I took the typing exam, I got three whacks from Father. I can't remember the principal's name, son of a bitch.
You got whacked?
Oh, yeah, because I didn't take the exam. And so my father and I were waiting, and my mother told me to hurry up and come home with the car because my sister was sick, and she wanted to take him to the doc, get her to the doctor.
Aunt Patty.
And so the way Aquinas did it to tell you whether or not to show up for graduation practice or not was to send you a telegram. So I was sitting there with my father at a nice summer's day, waiting to hear how my sister was, who had gone in for her, mom went to the hospital, dad stayed with me. Oh, okay. And waiting to see if we got the letter, because then my father was gonna probably either go down and tear Aquinas apart or get a lawyer and tear him apart, but, or the telegram. And Dick Penna stopped by the house, who was a classmate of mine, and hung around together quite a bit in high school and partway through college. And he said, come on, let's go over to Mary's house. And I said, no, I gotta wait and see if I get, you know, the telegram and so on and so forth. And I was kind of scruffy. I probably had on shorts or Levi's and a shirt, nothing. And we were just outside, probably having a beer since I was 21, or I was 18 at that point. You could drink in New York at the time when you were 18. And he said, oh, let's go. And surprisingly, my father told me, yeah, why don't you go? It'd be good for you to get out of the house. And Mary was holding my a surprise birthday party for me with a whole bunch of people at her mother's house. So that was pretty memorable.
Now, when we talked last time, you talked about going up to the Grand Canyon.
Several times. My grandparents, my mother's parents, moved from Seattle, Washington when my grandfather retired from the Milwaukee Railroad. He was a locomotive engineer. And he was in his late 60s before he retired.
And they moved from Milwaukee?
No, they moved from Seattle. Milwaukee Railroad ran from Chicago to Seattle.
Oh, okay.
Through Minneapolis, St. Paul. It was the Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul and Pacific Railroad, I think was the full name. But he worked the run to Everett, Washington from Seattle or someplace up there. I remember being in the steam engine with him once or twice, but he got out, diesels were coming. Plus, I mean, my God, he was in his late 60s, early 70s when he retired. And they moved from Seattle to Long Beach, which was a major change in climate. And they bought a house half a block off the ocean on Esperanza Avenue. And there was one empty lot between Ocean Boulevard and the beach, and it was right at the end of Esperanza, so you could actually see the water. You couldn't see the beach because there was about a 30 or 40 foot bluff that had dropped down, but they finally built on it, I guess, in the late 80s. It was finally built on when I was there. Went back in 96 or 97. But anyway, my parents, I remember going to Seattle once or twice. I remember part of the train trip. But when they moved to Long Beach, we started to drive out. And it would be my mother and my two sisters, because we would go after the exams were over, the school was out in New York, which wasn't until like the 15th of June, the 17th of June. And we would drive from, a couple different times. Once we just drove from New York to Pittsburgh on the one then superhighway, it wasn't an interstate because it didn't exist yet. I don't think they passed the bill. Eisenhower did that. But anyway, Pennsylvania Turnpike was open. And I remember the first time we went taking Mrs. Kirk, our next door neighbor, to go visit her family in Pittsburgh. I think we stayed with them that night. And then we drove from there to Chicago area to visit my mother's cousins. We stayed there. And then we worked our way across the country in western Illinois at Ohio, where Aunt May was, and then to Iowa, where the cousins from Chicago had a farm, and we spent time with them, and then Ted King out in Nebraska in different areas as
and
he moved around Nebraska.
Ted King?
Ted King was a student of my father's at the Merchant Marine Academy, and he used to babysit for me, or babysit for Dad and Mom.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
and then
so
he moved to Nebraska.
He's from Nebraska.
Oh,
and he went to I think he actually served in the Navy of the Merchant Marine on a short tour. He was like a 90-day wonder, went to OCS or whatever, maybe at the Merchant Marine Academy, because they ran the 90-day OCS, turn everyone into an officer in 90 days during World War II. But then he came back and got the 4-year Merchant Marine degree and sailed with the Navy and took the money he earned from that and used it to help pay for his farm out in Nebraska. He was from around Kearney, or at least that's where his original, that's where his first farm was, around Kearney, Nebraska, and then he moved to Alliance, Nebraska, which is even further north and west, and then when we took you there on the trip, he had already moved up to Sioux County I can't remember any of the town now. It's the only town in the county, and it's a county seat and everything else, population. 300 or 350. But anyway, we would go from Iowa across to Nebraska, and of course Mom, we talked about this before, Mom did it all by herself back then when there weren't interstate highways.
Mm-hmm.
I remember driving on US 30 up around Fort Wayne because they were talking about the Fort Wayne Pistons before they moved to Detroit, because they were sponsored by, I think it was True Ring Piston Company or whatever. I mean, they were called the Pistons because the company they worked for made piston rings and pistons for automobile engines. And I remember driving through the night, Indiana.
How did your mom do that?
She just did. She drove.
Self-entertained. Were you older too, or?
No, I was, Joe, or BJ was, let's see, first time was probably 1953, so BJ was 5 years older than I was, so she was probably 10 or 11. I, in 53, would have been 7 or 8. And, I think we did it in 53, 54, or maybe 53 and 55. And first time we stopped in Pittsburgh. The next time my mother drove straight through from New York to west of Chicago by herself. It was 20 some hours. I mean, that's why, your mother apparently has the same kind of stamina, because that's just the way we did things. I mean, that's the way we grew up. We would drive. I mean, I can remember leaving Long Beach at 5 o'clock, late at night, like at 10 o'clock at night, to cross the desert because you didn't have air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go through Las Vegas at 5 o'clock in the morning and then hit Bryce Canyon or one of the other places, because you could be there, sometime by noon. I don't remember exactly when. I know one time we went through and we ended up at the Royal Gorge and went down the funicular down to the bottom of the gorge and crossed the suspension bridge. Of course, now there's a whole big amusement park and everything there now, which I tried to. I want to take your mother to the Royal Gorge that last trip, and we looked at it and said, it was like $15 to get in, and we only wanted,
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, going back to the whole thing about the Grand Canyon, we would, from Nebraska, we went to Denver, and there was a cousin of my mother's who ran a Conoco station. And because I got to go to the gas station, which I thought was very cool, and of course you could see the mountains then. Even mm-hmm. in June, they were crystal clear, unlike now. And then from Denver, she would then drive from there down over to the Grand Canyon, Bryce, Zion. I don't know which ones. I know we went to the Grand Canyon usually last, I think, is the way it worked. She'd go to Bryce and then Zion, whatever. I'd have to try to look at the map and figure it out. And then the second trip, when I was, one I think you're talking about, I would have been 9 or 10 years old, probably had to be 1955, because my grandparents died in 56. Got to think about that. Anyway, we were on our way west again, and my sister had written to the Fred Harvey Company that ran the mule rides down the Grand Canyon to see if I would be allowed to go down, because I was below the age limit, which I think was, I probably was 9. That would have been, I would have been 9 and 55. I was born in 56. And I think you had to be 10 or 12 to go down. I don't remember what the rules were, but my sister actually wrote a letter to Fred Harvey, and they made an exception.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, we had to save our money, the allowance and stuff, because I think the trip cost, the 2-day trip at the time cost like $24, which was, it was a fair amount of money, but it was, we sold raspberries for 35 cents a pint basket. What are they now, $3?
Where did you get them?
We had our own raspberry patch at Kings Point. We had a big garden at Kings Point.
Hmm.
Because Mom and Dad had a victory garden in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So they did a lot of gardening. Well, that's what they encouraged everyone in World War II to grow their own vegetables and everything. I mean, they did a lot of growing. In Kings Point, they did too. Strawberries, raspberries, I mean, all the vegetables and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Patty would have been then about 3 years old, because I know on one of the trips she was still in diapers. And they actually had a form of paper diapers.
Mm-hmm.
I remember getting out, probably, I don't know what the problem was, I got car sick or altitude sickness or whatever, and I remember Joe had to help, BJ had to help change the padding, know, it was paper diapers, they were like layered of paper of some sort. But anyway, we camped all the way. Once we left Denver, we didn't... Well, no relatives. I mean, I do remember we did go to Salt Lake. We did stay in a motel there, so she drove, that one time she drove from Denver to Salt Lake nonstop, which is a good 500 miles, but no interstate. Because I remember going through, it was Gunnison, Colorado, Sunset, which was western Colorado. We got into the motel. It was late. It was a nice motel, too, because it had like a garden, and that's where I saw a big dragon flying. Amazing how I can remember that now. But anyway, we went out to the Great Salt Lake. So we went from, I guess that would have been from Salt Lake then, and then we drove down to Bryce and then Zion, because that's the way your mother and I did it. That would be a logical progression. And we had the reservations to go down, and my mother lost a day.
I wonder how that could happen. How are those people?
Three small children from 10 till 3. Of course, I mean, that's why I guess we like back roads too now, too, besides the traffic. But anyway, we got to the Grand Canyon and went to check in, you know, the next day or whatever, whenever we were there, and they said, oh, we're sorry, you missed it. And it's hard to believe now that the Grand Canyon at the North Rim it's still isolated, and it was even more isolated then because there was US 66, which is now Interstate 40, was all on the south side, and you went through that was the main route, it was US 66, and to do this you had to be, well, I mean, it did it with Bryce and Zion, but it was off the beaten path. And, I mean, there were no reservations for campgrounds, and you just went in, and there was always a campground. That's why you went to the North Rim. But anyway, they had, they said, well, you know, and they didn't have another trip scheduled for, I don't know, days. And we got lucky. There was a Chinese student. I don't know if he was from Taiwan or if he was a refugee or whatever, but I remember he didn't strike me as being real old, so he was probably a regular college student or maybe a graduate student. And he showed up, and they would go down. There were only three of us, plus the guy, Mark Hamlin. And the mule's name was Jen. Because when we went out to the beach for the art festival, we got plates, little plaques made, mule and mule things. But anyway.
Now, what did your mom and Patty do while you were on this two-day trip?
Oh, yeah, we were camping. Now, we had a Nash, it was just a Nash then at the time, it wasn't a Rambler, which was our smaller car. And it made into a bed. The front seats. There was a little latch at the base of the seats, and you push the seats forward and release the latch, and you put there were some bars that you put under the front of the back seat, and the front seats folded down, and they were relatively flat.
Huh.
So the whole car, I mean, what you essentially had was probably the equivalent of at least a double bed, I mean, because it was a good-sized car.
Uh-huh.
And
did you also use the car?
I don't remember. The weather, I mean, most of the time the weather was pretty good at the national parks unless you had an afternoon rain. And we may very well have had a tent, a little pup tent. It's odd that I can't remember that. Because I can remember my mother, she had an Army field jacket that she wore, which I was envious of.
And I always think of Granny Walsh as being kind of more like proper and...
That's what your mother thought until she went to until we took her to the truck driver's New Year's Eve party in Texas, and she was in there eating black-eyed peas and going nose to nose with the truck drivers, with the bourbon too. But no, I mean, Mom came across that way, but I mean, we camped all the way around, all the way across the country, so. But anyway, we had a great trip. We went, the trip from down the Grand Canyon on the North Rim, you go essentially straight down, you switch back all the way down, which takes you a fair amount of time. And then there's probably a good I can't tell you how many miles it is, but you got down in maybe 3 hours to the bottom, something like that, and then you had a regular trail ride across the bottom of the canyon. I'm sure it was going downhill, somebody was essentially flat. And we stopped at the water. I don't know if it was a hydro station or if it was a water pump station or both. But there was a family that lived down at the bottom of the canyon, at least there only during the summer, because the North Rim still closes down in the winter because of the snow and everything. But we stopped there for like a snack or coffee and whatever. And then along the trail, we stopped and had lunch under a waterfall. There was a little waterfall on the way on, because it was Bright Angel, I think it was Bright Angel Creek. And there was a stream coming off the side, and of course the guy didn't, whatever, so we had dinner or lunch there, and then you went to Phantom Canyon. We got there, I don't know, it was still pretty sunny out, which means that the sun still had to be relatively high. Mm-hmm. And there were cabins, nothing super fancy, and they had dammed up the creek, and they had a pool, kind of a rock-lined swimming pool. I don't know if there was any concrete in it or not. And had dinner there, and we walked down to the Grand, to the river in the Colorado, which at that time was still very muddy because you didn't have Glen Canyon Dam. Mm-hmm. And went across the suspension bridge,
and it was a beautiful day. And
the guide and myself, there was another group from the South Rim, but the ride down from the South Rim is you come down a series of steps, but it's a much shorter ride because you can go all the way down to the Colorado and back in a day if you want, I believe, from the South Rim.
Uh-huh.
The North Rim to the Phantom Canyon is much longer. And then we rode back up, and I remember the guy making fun of me because we stopped at have some water to drink at from the creek.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting for a cup, and of course my sister, the Girl Scout, just dipped her hand into the water and was kind of sucking, I guess, using her hand a cup of water. But anyway, we did get in the trip, and apparently I was the youngest person to go down the Grand Canyon on a commercial mule ride, because obviously the family, they had a kid my age, and they had ridden down.
Mm-hmm.
Probably ought to check this and make sure that it's recording.
And I just wanted her to know that I love her and that it's getting kind of...
Okay.
All right.
We're back.
Okay. Illnesses.
I had polio, or a very mild case of polio, when I was probably six or seven. We had gone, Father Dan Dolan, my mother's cousin, Aunt Frances' son, was in the seminary at Mary Nolan in Austin, New York, up on the Hudson River near Sing Sing. And we had gone up to spend the day and visit him, and we had come back, and it was probably a two-hour trip back, and I had gone to sleep in the back of the car. I mean, it was late, and I don't remember feeling sick, but when I ate real bad. My legs were real sore, and they thought it was just my legs, you know, I had curled up or whatever and fallen asleep, so they carried me up. I remember my dad carrying me up to bed, and then the next day I still had the problem, and fortunately, I guess, they decided that it must have been a mild case of polio, because I remember being in bed for a couple of days, and I guess ran a fever. I don't know what all the symptoms are. I mean, I wasn't terribly sick.
Mm-hmm.
But I was, my legs were very sore, and I don't all remember, but they later decided that I had had a mild case, and that's why I wasn't allowed to have the first polio vaccine right away, because that was the one that was using the live virus, and they didn't think that would be a good idea. Or something, whatever the deal was, I shouldn't say, I couldn't have been live virus, because otherwise they'd get polio, but whatever. So, there was that. And the only other thing that really I had a problem with, poison ivy, still count that as an illness. I had two terrible cases. One, I somehow got it on my butt, which was complicated by impetigo on top of the poison ivy. Well, I remember getting, they took me over, we could use my dad at the Merchant Marine Academy. They had medical, like in the military at the time. And they gave me little pills. It was, say, I think it was Dimetap or something like that back then, some kind of an antihistamine. And I had to lay in the tub with some kind of funky stuff to help with the itching and the impetigo, because they had to use, they used an ultraviolet lamp as a treatment too, because I mean, we had one. And I can remember having down on my buttocks on the back of my leg, and of course, you know, then flakes and blisters, and there was that, and I had some on my foot. I remember having a blister probably across the whole ball of my foot. Yeah. But, yeah, I remember BJ having that in hand, and it just looked like, well, you've ever seen my hand. I was very allergic to it, and there was lots of it. Point.
And Kings Point is where you live.
From 1947 to 1957.
Long Island.
That's on Long Island. We lived four houses.
You were born in New Jersey?
Yes, my parents lived in New Jersey from
Short Hills.
Short Hills, New Jersey, from the time they were married. I don't know where. Mom had an apartment, shared an apartment with two or three other girls in New York City. Yeah, it's funny. I don't know where Dad lived. He was still living at home.
How did they meet?
I believe it was through the Catholic. I want to say either the Catholic Poetry Society or it was a Catholic student
like
group.
Newman
like a Newman.
Like
it wasn't that. It wasn't Newman's Club, I don't think. But, met through some kind of a school thing, because I don't know, Mom I think was still teaching, well Dad was teaching at that time, I think he was teaching at Seton Hall. And I don't know if Mom was working as a social worker then, or she was, and maybe doing, maybe she was a social worker and doing some college teaching or vice versa, because she had a master's from Catholic U and social work, and Dad had his from Niagara in either history and or English. I don't know if it was both. But they met someone. It could have even been a Catholic peace group. Just it had something to do with a Catholic college or youth group.
Take
Friday
with me,
please. So, they built the house in Short Hills. As far as I know, they had the house built, and they did a lot of the work, I think, as I remember the story vaguely. And when Dad, and he was, like, I'm pretty sure he was teaching at Seton Hall, and even if he was teaching in New York, he could have taken the train in.
And then they moved
but,
to Kings Point.
Well, he got the job teaching at the Merchant Marine Academy. And somehow the house, actually it was the first house outside the gate at the time. On that side of the road, there was two or three houses. There were only two or three houses on the other side, and the first house was on the corner of Kings Point and Steamboat Road. And it was a house that had been built just prior to World War II or immediately after. And the guy built two houses very similar, and the guy got into some kind of financial problem or something. I don't know, there was something squirrely, but anyway, they got it. I think my mother's parents may have helped. When they sold that house in 1957, they got $25,000 for it, which was a hell of a lot. The house now, I have to be, has to be worth half a million, probably. But it was a three-story Tudor. Not since, probably 1970. The library had real diamond-shaped leaded windows. The fireplace was natural stone from the glaciers. I mean, they had beautiful stonework on the outside. There was some of it inside, and then there was a white, I guess they were painted white brick. I think they were painted, I can't remember for sure now. But a beautiful fireplace outside, because that was in the fenced-in playground, or fenced-in yard, mm-hmm. where our sandbox was. Dad built it. The chimney was a massive masonry chimney because it was also used for the oil furnace. Mm-hmm. It was a hot water furnace with a boiler and everything. And it had a half a bath. You walked into a double entry with a closet, like a little bit of a mudroom in front, and then you walk into this large central room, probably 10 by 12. Library was to the right. The dining room that was probably twice the size of our dining room. You could open up a full table, great big table, and still have room around it. Dad built a beautiful knotty pine buffet with kitchen cabinets and indirect lighting and stuff on, because that one also had leaded windows. If I remember correctly, they had leaded windows on one wall in the dining room too. Then there was a dinette, and then the kitchen, and then you went down to the basement from there, in the back steps out the back door, which is really a side door. And to the left was a living room, probably almost as big as ours, maybe a little wider, but not as. It was a big fireplace. There were windows all on two walls, but I can't remember what they were, just ordinary windows or what. And then you went, there the central steps were directly ahead of you, and you could go up two steps and then continue upstairs, or you could go up down two steps if you went straight and into the dinette. And there was four bedrooms on the second floor with a bath that connect with a bath with a shower connecting my mother's room and BJ and Patty's room. And well, Patty and BJ eventually slept there together. There was a separate full bath with a separate shower and a tub for anyone. I had the corner bedroom, and my bedroom was probably as big as our bedroom at home, at least. And BJ's and Patty's was even bigger, and they had a window, a built-in windows bay. Well, I think it was offset. Maybe there were closets, but I know there was a storage compartment you could pick up and a place to sit on and look out the windows. And then on the third floor, there was, I guess, I don't know, supposed to be a maid's facility. There was another, there was a cedar closet, and a great big walk-in cedar closet, another full bath, and a bedroom up there, because Mom and Dad rented the room out to several different people. Some couple, they weren't students. Don Mahana was the one guy that was there all the time. Quite a while. I think he had something to do with the academy. But they used that to help pay the rent because the taxes got terribly expensive in by 1955, I think the taxes were $950. Well, what happened is the area developed. We talked about this because I remember seeing these trucks that were driven by chains from the transmission back. They didn't have drive shafts. They had great big sprockets to the chains. That's what they used for the big dump trucks then. And they were driving back and forth because the whole area had been made up of estate. The academy was built on the old Chrysler estate overlooking Long Island Sound. The Sinclairs of Sinclair Oils estate was down the road on Long Island Sound. And those estates were broken up and put up, you know, they weren't the Levittowns. These were the people who had the money. And Great Neck, I don't know what the population was, 10, 15,000. Maybe a little bit bigger, but they had been small towns. And after World War II, there was an influx of people from New York City out to the island to get out in the country. And the Great Neck had a large Jewish population. There was one Catholic church and five synagogues. I mean, that's the kind of rich. I mean, and there were, of course, obviously, the Episcopal Church and so on. And there was a Negro population. There was a little enclave of blacks. I don't know how they ended up there, because there was an area. But the schools were atrocious. I mean, the grammar schools had a home ec department. They built these. Oh, I remember, because we went to the Catholic school, and you know, we had a brand new addition to the school, because they're all the baby boomers. I mean, these schools were low slung windows all over the place, because we would ride the bus with the public school students. And they would, you know, we'd go by some of theirs, we'd pick them up from some of the schools, and I remember my dad complaining about it. But they wanted these great schools, and they had the money to pay for it. Because Dad's income, I think, when he left the academy, was pretty good, but it was like $8,500 a year. 10% of your total was going up to for taxes. So I don't know if we would have been able to stay there or not. But what was the original question?
Illnesses.
Poison ivy. And the only other thing we had left was when I was about 19 and had my tonsils out finally. But it had been preceded by a series of illnesses, you know, just typical chronic. And my mother, I remember talking about this too. Mom and Dad, the pediatrician said, don't get your tonsils out, which was just against all of the rules back then. Well, my mother took it to the, you know, kind of like your mother, they tell her and she buys it. And so, I mean, I was 19 when I had my tonsils out. And actually, in one case, I don't know if it was directly related to the tonsil, but I had a pneumococcus infection, which was very close to becoming pneumonia. And it was only 3 weeks after I met, no, maybe 2.5 weeks after I met your mother, we went up to
and
Toronto.
From wherever.
Well, that's what it started off with was we had sold the most something for tickets for ads or whatever for Aquinas for the foot. It had something to do with selling something for the football, because football was a big deal at Aquinas. And our homeroom won. And we won. The reward was we were taken to Toronto for the Aquinas, I think it's St. Michael's High School. Aquinas, the Bazillion Fathers ran a college and a high school in Toronto. And the basketball team was playing them up in Toronto, and we took two bus loads from the homerooms and went up for the day and if you can imagine, two bus loads of students going to a buffet. And it was a very nice buffet because they had baby lobster tails, which I didn't like at the time. And coming back, my throat was bothering me, and I didn't go to school the next, I think it was Sunday, and I didn't get any better. I was supposed to go, your mother had asked me to go to the Nazareth Christmas dance, which was the first big, we had the football, or the end of the football season, fall dance, and I didn't know your mother then, and then the girls' schools had the Christmas dances in Rochester, and the doctor wouldn't let me go. Your mother had bought the dress, so on, and I ended up going, I was allowed, it was too goofy, but I was allowed to go out and bring her corsage and stuff, but I wasn't allowed to go to the dance. And then 2 days later, the girl from Iowa that I had met through your aunt and so on, showed up. She wasn't, you know how your mother is, she wasn't buying all this. I mean, I'd only met her 3 weeks before, but anyway, those were the three major illnesses. Got my tonsils out when I was probably 20. Oh yeah, before I got married, it was actually postponed because the guy who was supposed to do it, the doctor was killed in an automobile accident, so I had to wait another 6 weeks. So I had him out in the middle of the summer. Yeah. And went in that morning, had him out, and then stayed overnight. And they served me, I remember telling you this, they served me grapefruit juice, the first thing to have to drink. Yeah. Grapefruit juice.
Ugh.
It was ugly.
Okay. Tell me your favorite food. What was your favorite?
I think we went through this before.
Yes, he said everything.
You've
had 6 months to think about it now, or 3 months.
I haven't thought about it anymore. There isn't. I don't know. Surf and turf. I mean, and you know me. There isn't too much there are things I don't like, but. Yeah. I'll eat fried chicken without bones.
Fried chicken breast?
Boneless chicken breast, I have no problem with.
Okay.
That goes back because my mother cooked chicken and it was cooked, kind of sauteed, and then she made it gravy. Yeah, I just.
Slimy.
That's what I think, slime. I don't know if I could get the shrimp scampi. I've hardly ever been able to duplicate it. That Maurice at the one and only bar and grill in Kings Point used to make. He was a chef. He was a Filipino cook from the Navy. Came from a very wealthy Filipino family. He was supposed to go to Annapolis before World War II, and he couldn't wait, and so he joined the Navy. The only thing you could be in the Navy at that point was a Filipino was some kind of a cook.
Mm-hmm.
He married an Irish woman, and he ended up running his bar and grill, which made the best damn pizza and the best cooked his scampi in a 500 degree pizza.
Favorite vegetable?
Carrot? No. I guess I'd go for peas and carrots.
Really? I'm surprised. Mixed?
Oh, yeah.
Frozen?
Actually, I like, in some way.
You don't like canned.
Canned peas are about the only thing. I mean, I'm not. Well, I like fresh peas or frozen peas, but of all the canned vegetables, peas are about the only ones I think that I could eat, other than maybe like pickled peas.
Huh? That's a time of
me. I was brought up on canned peas, and we always had peas and carrots. I mean, the reason we don't have peas and carrots at our house is because Mom doesn't eat peas, so we're never going to have those. I mean, I get peas, but.
Favorite
dessert?
That's pie?
Or, I don't know, latte and cake and apple crisp pie or cherry pie, I guess.
Okay. Favorite restaurant?
I'd pick one and fried steel for
Denim's. Okay. And favorite color?
Texas Rangers or butter cookies. Shortbread cookies, yeah.
Okay, this is where it is. Oh, that works.
The professionals would probably have to buy one. That's kind of tough because there's so many genres, but I'd probably go with professionals because there's really some romance in it, there's comedy, there's very serious drama in it.
I saw it once that I didn't want to. Okay, tell me about school.
Grammar.
Who's your favorite teacher?
What grade? I mean, what?
Well, you can break it up, grammar school, middle school, high school.
Grammar school would have to be Sister Annette. I had her for 6th and 7th grade because we ran a split 6th and 7th grade class.
All in the same class?
Yeah. Gotta remember, it was baby boom time. That was in Long Beach.
And this was in California.
Yeah. I went from 5th through sophomore year of high school at St. Anthony's. I went to St. Anthony's Grammar School and to St. Anthony's High School, both run by the parish. And
now, grammar school, you would have been in two.
At St. Aloysius,
okay.
Kindergarten through fourth grade.
And then the fifth grade, you moved up to California and started to move.
Right.
And then your junior year, you moved back to Rochester.
Back to Rochester to get your clients.
That.
I was a big man on the campus. I was on the football team. We had a new coach. I was supposed to be a big time starter in California. Had a Mormon girlfriend.
Mormon?
Yeah. Well, she was a girlfriend at the time. But then she dumped me because she went to Salt Lake City and no, realized that she was a Mormon and I was a Catholic and, just wasn't going to work. And that happened in the middle of the summer that I was getting ready because I'll tell you how Dad got the job, because he moved out to Kings Point or to Long Beach for him to go to University of Southern California, because it was the first school in the country to develop a doctoral program for college administrators. There was no formal training for college administrators.
You became a college professor.
You became a professor, or somehow you worked in the business office, or it just happened. You could get a PhD in secondary education or elementary ed and all that, but you couldn't get it in college administration.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad had been working on his PhD down at the University of Pennsylvania when he was at the academy, and he had a commuter ticket from New York to Pennsylvania. He'd take the Long Island. I don't know how he got down to the Long Island station. It was in Great Neck. Maybe Mom drove him, or he may have taken the bus. The bus from the academy would go directly to the station. Mm-hmm. I doubt he drove the car, because my mother wouldn't like that, because he would leave like on a Friday afternoon, go down for Friday evening classes, and then Saturday classes. They had it set up, obviously, for full-time day, or for people who had full-time jobs. And he had a commuter ticket, New York to Philadelphia on the Penzi, and of course the Penzi then, they'd run 100 miles an hour, it was only an hour. He probably, from the time he got on I don't know how much time he had to allow for the trains from Long Island, went right into Pennsylvania Station,
mm-hmm.
and he got on to the Penzi, and they ran 10, 15 trains a day between New York and, Washington,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even Boston, I don't know, but get on, and they ran close to 100 miles, 80, 90 miles an hour back then. Same ones the Amtrak runs on now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the same electric overhead wires. And then he'd come back home. He had a rooming house, or had some deal worked out, someplace cheap to spend the night, and then he went to classes Saturday, and then he would come home Saturday evening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if he did it every Saturday. But anyway, this is all background, but this was on the tape too, we talked about. My father was one of the precedent setting kids. Well, he ended up suing the academy. They came in, their whole promotions and grade levels and everything for all of the faculty and the service staff at the Merchant Marine Academy, which was a uniform service. The Maritime Administration actually ran, just like public health, is a uniform service. Like USAA has always allowed public health officers. The academy does, and there's a maritime administration, but I don't know what they do because there aren't very many American flag ships left.
But yeah, because they would teach people to sail who weren't in the Navy.
Well, and they all were. You were in the Naval. You were Navy ROTC as part of it.
Okay.
So they all, when they graduated, they came out with a degree in either marine engineering or I think they called it marine science if you were a deckie.
Uh-huh.
If you were an engineer, you had an marine engineering degree, and you were, because that's a, both of those are Coast Guard certified and licensed and so on. So, one, you would become the chief engineer of the ship if you stayed long enough, or you would eventually become get a captain's license and could sail ships. And the Navy, of course, loved them because at Annapolis, they don't teach you marine engineering per se, or to be a lot of the nautical science and nautical engineering is kind of, well, you might get a little bit of the courses at the Merchant Marine Academy. You were, that's what you were there to be trained for. So when they came out, they were crackerjack navigators because they spent a year at sea. Their sophomore year, they would be assigned to different ships. They would sail for a whole damn year.
And what did your dad teach?
History and English. But he was really tight with the guys up in the electronics department, which was on the fourth floor, third or fourth floor, the next floor up. Because there was a guy named Art Frazier who developed a navigation long before you had computers and stuff. And it was just a series of triangles and methodologies that would prevent ship collisions. And my dad was so good at it that Art Frazier would use him because he would sell these things. And he'd use my dad as part of his demonstrations. They would bring people in or they'd go out to different shipping companies. But anyway, all of the Maritime Act of like 1939, this is stuff I just picked up listening to my father and his court cases and stuff, said that they were to be, if you were an English teacher with X number of years history, you would be at the same grade as the equivalent of the Coast Guard Academy.
Okay.
So everything was geared to the Coast Guard Academy, another uniformed service. In 1955, for some unknown reason, the Maritime Administration decided they were going to make everyone civil service, which meant you lost your uniform, you no longer got quarters and allowance, which was non-taxable, you didn't get subsistence, you didn't get medical. I mean, they would give you Blue Cross Blue Shield equivalents, but I would go to the Academy Hospital anymore. They had a hospital / dispensary and stuff. I mean, that's where I went to get treated for poison ivy.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, they came in and recategorized everyone. Dad took like a $800 pay cut. Which was, he lost like 10%. Now some people got more money. But they never changed the law.
So they just did it.
Never put in the enabling legislation to change it, which is what it required. You had to go to Congress and change it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, the Maritime Act was a public law. And my dad had a lot of connections with people in New York City that, one, because he lived in New York City and people he knew from different colleges he taught at, because he taught at Fordham, evening classes, that's something else he did. He taught evening classes at Fordham, and he taught at Seton Hall and at St. John's, I believe, at different times. I don't know if he taught at Seton Hall afterwards, part-time. That would have been a hall, but I know he taught at Fordham because he taught to Miss Rheingold one year. Rheingold's a local Brooklyn beer, and they had a Miss Rheingold contest, which was a big deal in the Brooklyn, New York City area, and they had a big contest.
And I remember because I got a big cardboard portrait of her, and it was Miss, one of the, one year it was Miss Rheingold was one of the students. But anyway, somehow, I mean, he had connections with, like one of the guys he taught with at one of the, somewhere before World War II. Turns out he was, his family was a millionaire mill company owners up in New England. And he got his, I think he got his PhD. He was teaching college. And just before the war, or when the war was starting, maybe to get out of the war, he went to medical school. I mean, he was like 25, 27 years old. And he went to medical school and graduated, got his, became a doctor. We went to visit him up in Kennebunkport. And Dad was saying, well, you know, they had like six kids and we had four kids. And this was, there were five of us. He had like three or four kids and so on. But they wanted us, the year that we moved out to California, we went up to, they said, please come up before you head west. Mm-hmm. And stop in and see us. And we went up there, and there was a doctor friend that they had, Stumps. And they had a place up on Lake Sebago, or Sebago Lake in Maine. And BJ was really tight with Mrs. Stump, and there were three Stump boys who were around her age. She had a crush on one of them. And they went up like a week ahead. And then we were invited up for 3 or 4 days, and we stayed in their guest cottage, which was, it really was a cabin. And I mean, all the pine, and they had a Chris Craft. Well, they were lovely. Anyway, we went from there, and we're really worried because, you know, there's this cottage in Kennebunkport. It was as big as our house in Kings Point, except that it had at least 8 bedrooms because down in the kitchen, there was a thing that you could push in your room, and it would ring and it would show which bedroom was ringing for service. And they did have a maid and a caretaker. And he was having a lobster boat built for him to go cruising. I mean, so he knew people like this from, because I guess there was, it sounds somewhat put on, but there was an intellectual group of people. Dad was a real intellectual. And he was involved in a lot of things, and he had, so in an area like New York City, you don't see it as much in places like this, but you wouldn't necessarily have the money, but because if you were, you have connections because you were involved in organizations because of your intellect and your teaching and so on. Somehow he ended up with a guy named, it was Shipman and Ackerley, and I forget which one was which, but he had got introduced to this one lawyer, a high-powered lawyer in New York City, and then he went into, and I don't know how Dad decided to do it. I remember him talking with Mom about it, and he being around for it, and they were going to fight it and so on, and he went in on his own, I think initially, or maybe with a couple others, because everyone was afraid that, you know, if they fought, they'd lose their job. And what were you going to do? Because everyone would have to sue to go to court individually.
Right.
And Dad's case, it was Walsh et al. Versus the U.S. Maritime Administration. I think this is the way it read. Or no, actually, it may have even had the name of the chief of the Maritime Administration, or whatever they actually called the organization. But because Dad asked the guy later, he said, well, why did you take our case? It wasn't that much money. And they ended up, the lawyer down in Washington was a member, I mean, he was a member of the Republican National Committee. I mean, he was a high-powered Washington lawyer, and apparently the guy in New York was a high-powered New York lawyer. And Dad, that case and a case by an Indian tribe out west set the precedence for class action suits.
Huh.
So all this bullshit that we go through with some of these class action suits, which have gotten out of hand, go back to my father and the Indians.
Huh.
So anyway, he was suing the Merchant Marine Academy, and that started in 1955, and ended up, he got interested in college administration, obviously, after that, and decided he couldn't do it at the academy because his dissertation as a government employee would be reviewed by the academy.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to, and what his, he ended up doing his dissertation on the federal academies, on Annapolis, and how they, I mean, dealing with something. I'd have to sit down and read it. I never have read it. I probably should. But I mean, I was, it was great because I got the court case when we went out to Long Beach. A couple of years later, we took the train back.
Mm-hmm.
That's another whole story. We were talking about...
Favorite teachers.
And Sister Annette, I had her both in sixth and seventh grade. She was just the sweetest woman. And she was the one I told you the story. We got to go see a movie one. We were good kids, it was vacation or whatever, and we went to see the Dizzy Dean story, which is about a baseball pitcher for the St. Louis Browns or Cardinals or whoever they were. And he was quite a character. I mean, he eventually went on and did play-by-play broadcasts and so on, but he was, he and his brother were part of the Gas House gang, I think they were called. But